And welcome to the weekend. I'm your host, Jim Stevens. This is the Sandler Training Hour. We invite a Sandler trainer, keynote speaker to join us each week to discuss the strategies, improved behaviors, techniques, and attitudes regarding business development, customer service, and sales. My guest today is Dave Arch. And in our circle in Sandler, Dave Arch is a legend. Dave Arch is a master of engaging people in training, and he runs courses to help us trainers get better at training. He's written the book Transforming Leaders the Sandler Way, one of many books that he has read. Dave, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me, Jim.
Well, I was hoping, Dave, we could talk a little bit today about leadership. So I love your book, Transforming Leaders, which if you're interested, you can go to our website, crossroads.sandler.com. It's available there. You can go to Amazon, any of the internet sites to get it. And the format that Dave writes the book in really is topical in nature. It helps you identify specific areas where we as leaders tend to have strengths and in one area that we may tend to overuse. And then there's other areas where we may lack a talent or skill, and we might need to develop those. So, Dave, let's talk about Transforming Leaders the Sandler Way.
Transforming Leaders the Sandler Way. I wrote the book like I like books to be written. So the books that I like to read are in short bursts. They're not lengthy. They're short chapters. I like books that aren't sequential. I don't like to have to start at the beginning and read to the end. So these are really, if you think of it as a series of short articles on necessary leadership behaviors, attitudes, and techniques. You can pick the book, open it anywhere, or go to the table of contents and read the table of contents and go, oh, that sounds interesting. Go to that section and read it. No chapters longer than 2 or 3 pages long. So they really are article length. And then you could set about applying that to your leadership, you know, before you go on and read another one. So it's, that's the format of it. And it's the principles that I've gleaned over the years of leading.
One of the things you talk about, Dave, is the velvet brick. Interesting concept. Unpack that for us.
Well, I currently spend my time doing executive coaching. And I believe a great leader is like a velvet covered brick, soft, approachable, vulnerable, easy to get close to. But if you push, it's not long before you feel something of substance. There's a substantive core, and that's the brick part. And I spend most of my coaching fine-tuning the velvet and the brick. Many leaders are too bricky, and they're very difficult to get close to. They're almost a little abrasive. And some are too velvety. You push, and you sink up to your first knuckle, and they need a little less velvet. And so it's adjusting that so that that leader has that velvet-covered brick composition that summarizes for me in a metaphor what a truly great leader is like.
So it's really about finding the right proportions, finding the right ratio of direct, hard-hitting brick and soft, cushy velvet.
Well, yes. In Sandler, we speak a lot about transactional analysis, the parent, the adult, the child. It's that balance between the nurturing parent, which is someone who comes alongside you and cares about you almost in a mentoring way, but is also able to deliver hard truth in their adult. Not necessary to have any emotion, but just puts it out there. If this doesn't change, this is going to be the result. And in saying that with no emotion, I find as I work with leaders, that's probably one of the greatest investments of time in terms of return on the investment is learning to make statements with no emotion. And I encourage the people that I work with to stand in front of a mirror. I love the catchphrase, that could be a problem. Just stand in front of a mirror and say it. That could be a problem. Keep all emotion out. When you get good at that, you can deliver just about any kind of a message without getting that emotional kickback from the person who's receiving it. Boy, you've got to be able to speak with no emotion, not even the twitch of an eyebrow. That often is a hard discipline to capture and maintain.
I thought it would take a little longer than 5 minutes for you to hit a nerve, but you've done
it. What do you mean by that?
You nailed me. That is one of the biggest challenges I have. It's that I am a very passionate person and my natural style is a brick.
Yes.
if I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. It's that kind of attitude, right?
And
as a business owner and as a leader, I tend to lead by telling, which in my mind is very efficient. I can efficiently tell you what to do.
In action,
it's ineffective. So it's not effective because it doesn't really work. Most people go away after being told what to do and either don't do that or do it under protest. And so that's, I think, part of what you're talking about. Unpack that for us.
Well, I think so. I think what we're really talking about, again, going back to transactional analysis, I have to learn to substitute my critical parent. So I'm tempted to say, now that could be a problem. And in my critical parent, that's going to trip in the other person, either the rebellious child, this is basically what you said, they're going to go away and not do it. They're going to go away muttering under their breath, you're not the boss of me, and then not do it. Or the compliant child, in which they shake their head yes in front of me, but still don't do it. And so I'm going to trip that if I do it from my critical parent. But if I shift what I'm tempted to say in my critical parent, if I shift that to my adult and say the very same message, but with no emotion, just the facts. If this doesn't happen, we're going to need to let you go. I can say that with no emotion. When I come to that point, then I don't trip the rebellious child. In fact, most of the time they come back to me and go, you know, if I say to them, now that could be a problem, they will say, what could be a problem? And I'm not tripping that part of them that is counterproductive to what I want to get done.
And I also engage their sense of discovery. Instead of telling them, we have this problem, you need to fix it. Now, if I'm under the gun and somebody says that to me, I'm going to feel pretty not okay, pretty under attack. I'm going to get defensive, and that doesn't lead to discovery.
Right. And you don't get my buy-in on the solution. And I think that's when a leader often finds themselves out in front, turning around, looking for their troops, and their troops are way back there because they said, here's what we're going to do, so get in line and let's do it. And then they marched off, and their troops were standing there kind of going, what's he doing? And he's out by himself because he didn't wait for the buy-in of the troops.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The brick is having the clear understanding of what are our expectations, and the velvet is being able to deliver those expectations in a non-threatening way that allows self-cognitive change to occur rather than becoming that persecutor.
Well, and I'd take it just one more step. I think a great leader has divided. They've made a distinction between their standards and their expectations. Standards, I kind of get from an external source. Here are the standards I have for the performance of this job, but my expectations come from my understanding of the individual who's performing in the job, and my expectations for everybody is not the same. My expectations adjust to the individual. My standards seldom deviate, but I believe that a great leader has distinguished those two in his or her mind.
So I like the concept, Dave, of a non-emotional statement of fact. Intellectually, I get that, but I, and this is probably an excuse, I'm a very passionate person.
Yes.
And
yes.
My natural default is to, and in addition to that, I'm dramatic.
Right. Absolutely. I put emotion behind what I say.
So how do I learn how to throttle that back? Give me a suggestion, a hint, or a tactic.
Oh, I think Sandler speaks to it when he says, you put it in your upfront contract. You stick it in your upfront contract. We're going to have a conversation here, and I need you to know this about me. Sometimes I get emotional. Sometimes I get too passionate. Sometimes I get all wound up. But please understand, I'm trying to be as non-emotional as possible, and I want to just put the facts on the table. I'm going to do my best, and if you'd help me with that, I'm going to give you a sign. I'm breaking character now. I'm going to give you a sign my wife uses with me. She takes her fingers like she's turning a knob, and she goes, and she turns it clockwise. It's like, there, if we're out in public and I suddenly get myself all ramped up and I'm talking louder than I should, and I get all, she just goes, like she's turning a knob. And that's her silent signal to me. And I would give the person on the other end of my delivery permission to give me that sign. Help me, just give me the silent sign. You won't offend me. Just give me this silent sign that I need to roll it back to a little more measured approach, because that is my ultimate goal. I'm just not very practiced at it.
Awesome. Dave Arch is my guest today. Dave, give your contact information in case somebody'd like to reach out to you.
If you want to reach out to me, you just email me dave@sandler.com. Dave@sandler.com. When they were handing out those email addresses, I stood to the first of the line. So I got a pretty simple email address.
Yeah. And much to the chagrin, I would say, of our CEO, who is Dave Mattson.
But to his credit, he's not asked for it back.
So, well, if he does, put a high price tag on it, would you?
That's right.
And I'm Jim Stevens. Visit our website at www.crossroads.sandler.com and download the 3 biggest mistakes salespeople should never make. For specific questions or comments, you can call us at 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. And welcome to Entrepreneur Radio. I'm your host, Jim Stevens. In this segment of our program, we get to interview the real heroes of our economy and society, independent business owners and leaders. We have them share their life experience with us. And today I'm just delighted to have Gary McCracken. He's the owner of Clothesline Cleaners. You've probably driven by one of his stores many, many times. What you have not known is the personality that runs those stores. And I think we have a big treat for our listeners today, Gary. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Jim. Glad to be here.
Gary is an entrepreneur's entrepreneur. I got to hear the story about his grandfather, who was the founder of Union Farm and Garden. If you're a longtime resident here in Idaho, you remember the Union Farm and Garden stores. It's where the Idaho Youth Ranch is now, is one of the stores. And Gary learned to be an entrepreneur early on. Share with us a little bit about your granddad and how you learned to be entrepreneurial.
Well, I didn't work directly for my grandfather. By the time I was of working age, he was just retiring. But I did go to work for his company, Union Farm and Garden, and they immediately sent me out to the nursery, moving nursery stock around, trees and shrubs and whatnot. And I ended up with a great respect and love for gardening as a hobby, but it really taught me a good work ethic. Going in, setting an alarm to make it to work on time over the weekends, right after school, while I was still in high school, and I still have the work ethic.
That's awesome. And one of the things that an entrepreneur does is looks for opportunities. And you found the opportunity of helping people by digging holes and planting shrubs as that added value to make their purchases really complete. And Gary has continued that level of service into his career of cleaning. So tell us a little bit, how in the world does someone decide to become a cleaner?
Well, I didn't decide to become a cleaner. It was after I'd graduated from high school. My intention was to go into bookkeeping and become an accountant like my father.
Wow.
And I took an accounting course in high school and realized that was not what I wanted to do. And didn't know what I wanted to do, but told my folks at dinner one night that I thought I should wait a while to go to college after graduation. And it was only a few weeks after that. My dad had been an accountant for most of his career, worked with Simplot, but he had gone into commercial real estate a couple of years before that. And he sat me down for dinner one night and said, you know, if you're not going to go to college directly out of high school, why don't we work on a project together? He had a small mom and pop dry cleaner that was listed for sale. He had recently sold some property that he wanted to create a tax shelter for that money that he had made. And he said, you know, I can buy this place and over 2 years create the tax shelter that he needed. It'd give me an opportunity to go into business and learn some business management experience. And after 2 years, he'd sell it. He'd get his benefit. I'd get a benefit and I could go on to college from there and be somebody.
Wow.
We often joked after that because I never did quit the dry cleaners. The 2 years came and went and I wasn't ready to leave. Decided to stay on and soon started buying into the business with my father. And about 15 years ago, we bought him out and became the sole owners.
Wow,
and so it turned into a career. It wasn't a plan, but it just worked out that way.
And your dad is an entrepreneur too. Wow.
Well, my grandfather was the real entrepreneur. My father, like I said, was mostly in accounting, worked for Simplot Corporation, had a great career with them. He's passed now. We miss him, but he did get into commercial real estate there in the end of his working days. And it just so happened that an opportunity came along that has benefited me in my life.
That is fantastic. So today in our show, I wanted to highlight some of the things that I think most business owners maybe don't realize. And that is, how do I convey to my clients that I do great work? It is not uncommon for companies to do a great job, but it is very uncommon for clients to notice that they're doing a great job. And we have to broadcast somehow, some way to our clients the extra touches that we offer. And I think you've done some brilliant things in your organization to help take the dry cleaning industry to a whole new level. So give us the background of your attention to detail in cleaning that led you to discover, how do I help my clients really realize that we are great at what we do?
Well, one of the things that we noticed early on was that our competition can clean clothes. They can clean, they can press.
Right.
That's the common denominator. Some of us use different solvents, but we basically do the same thing. The differences for us have come in the packaging and the end process. Once an item is cleaned and pressed and it passes inspection, we've developed some packaging processes which we feel greatly elongate the wearability of that garment. If you've ever had things in your closet for some time,
mm-hmm.
and they just stay there, they kind of get smashed in between other pieces and move back and forth. By the time you pull that item out, it could be wrinkled just from being pressed and kind of smashed place. So the tissue, collar supports, cuff clips, special packaging items that provide a breathable experience so that you can keep your items in those packages for longer, we feel help the wearability of items long after they've been cleaned and are it just in a storage type situation.
Plus, it says to us as the consumer that there has been some second level care and concern given to the garment.
That's true. For a person that is a regular customer of the dry cleaner, when they use clothesline cleaners, when they receive their items back, it's almost instantaneous that they start noticing a difference in the way that things are packaged and prepared and delivered back to the customer. One of the things that we don't have on the outside of our packaging or the items that we work on that is a little harder to convey to the customer is the level of education that we have. We have two certified professional dry cleaners out of the Dry Cleaning and Laundry Institute back in Washington, D.C., and we're working on our third right now. We have a young lady that's going to go back to school in October, and she'll get certified at that time. And just having that much knowledge about our industry and the specifics on textile care goes a long ways in providing the type of experience that our customers expect.
It makes sense that there is a certification, but I sure haven't heard about that. How many folks are certified in our area?
Well, Jim, I'm glad you asked that, actually. We've used some marketing in the past, and we continue to use it as long as it's still effective and true. We say, let me see if I can paraphrase, Idaho has only two certified cleaners. Both work here. And at this point, we are the only two in the state of Idaho that are certified. It's not required.
Yeah.
But we feel like it's necessary.
It says something.
Yes.
Yeah. In our remodeling company, we're certified remodelers. I mean, what does that mean? Well, it means we've gone above and beyond to learn the industry and to develop the credibility and the knowledge and the skills. So I think it does. Now, does it mean I do a better job? Maybe, maybe not. Because like you said, my competitors know how to clean clothes. And I think the thing that as a consumer today, we look for, I think convenience is one of those things. So I think they say location, location, location is what's going to drive marketability of a property as well as the loyalty of a consumer. You take location to a whole new degree by delivery. So talk to us about your delivery service and program.
Oh, well, our delivery is essential to our business success. We only have two full-time delivery trucks that are out and about. We cover virtually all of Ada County twice a week.
Mm.
But those two delivery vans pick up 50% of the pieces that we work on. And we have four store locations.
Wow.
So two trucks pick up half the business that four locations are working on. So the route is essential to our success. And our best customers tend to use the route. It's very convenient for them. And we seem to have a longer retention of customers that choose to be on the route versus those customers that we wait on to come in and visit at one of our stores.
But that sounds expensive. How much is it going to cost me to have you deliver?
Well, there is no charge for the delivery. That's complimentary. That's one of the nice things
about the service. So the full route is complimentary.
It's part of the service that we offer, wow. Yes.
Yeah, that's awesome. I guess I might have to have you start cleaning our clothes.
Be happy to help you out, Jim.
One other thing that I love about Gary is he's a giver, and he's been working with the Boise Rescue Mission for years on a men's clothing drive. And so every year you accumulate clothing and that people either donate to you or they fail to pick up, they've moved or whatever, and you turn around and donate that. So tell us about the upcoming clothing drive that you have going on.
Oh, this is a great benefit. We got involved with the Boise Rescue Mission, I think it was about 2010, and it was such a success that year. We've just been doing it every year, and we kind of expect to continue for as long as we can. In November, we will begin what we call the Men's Suit Drive. It is a benefit for the Boise Rescue Mission, and we ask the general public, not just our customers, we will market via text and emails and signage, word of mouth to our own customers, but the greater community is invited to participate. We take in garments through our route and any one of our stores throughout the month of November. One of our locations has a wide open area with lots of hanging rack space so that we can store these things. Mm. We spend about 30 days gathering them up, and at the end of the month, usually around the 1st of December, we make a big handoff to the Boise Rescue Mission. Our first year out of the chute, we had about 800 items that were donated. Last year was one of the lower years, and maybe we just didn't have the publicity, but we still took in over 600 pieces to donate.
Wow.
Our biggest year to date, and we'd like to see this one eclipsed, is over 1,500 pieces donated in 1 month's time.
That's phenomenal. And the Boise Rescue Mission is something that is near and dear to, I think, almost all Boiseans' heart. We really appreciate the help that they do for the homeless and disadvantaged. How do they utilize the clothing that gets donated?
Well, they have a men's program specifically. Of course, they help families, women and children, anybody in need of assistance at any time for any reason. But we had donated some items to the ladies' program, Dress for Success, years ago. And we had some men's things to give away too, but they didn't take the men's items. Hmm. And at that point, we kind of searched and found the Boise Rescue Mission had a men's program specifically. They help provide some education, some retraining to these men that are, for whatever reason, down on their luck and just needing a bit of assistance. And so the new and or refurbished clean pressed garments go a long ways towards creating a good first impression for these guys when they're ready to set sail and make the venture back out into the business community. Getting a job interview is a big step, and being properly dressed for that interview is very important. And these clothes that are donated serve that purpose.
I liked how you said we never get a second chance to enter the room. So talk to us a little bit about the importance of those first impressions.
Well, a first impression is a lasting one, Jim. And unfortunately, we all like to think that we're above that quick
prejudice, right?
Yes,
judgment.
But human nature, we just can hardly help that. You just end up kind of sizing people up instantaneously before you even realize it. And if you walk into a job interview and you're going to ask somebody for a job and you're not dressed appropriately, you may be very qualified, but you've created a bad impression that you're trying to overcome, and you may not even know that that's what you're overcoming. Some of these folks had the clothes on their back,
right,
when they ended up at the mission. And so having a few pieces that help them out along the way is wonderful. And if you think about the other end of that, there are so many of us that have clothes in our closet right now that are not getting worn.
Right.
For whatever reason, we were emotionally attached to that item when we bought it,
yeah,
or we received it maybe.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, we've lost that fire and desire, and that garment just sits there and it's collecting dust across the shoulders or across the top of the pant where they're folded, and they're doing nobody any good. So this is a way that we can all get involved with our own community and repurpose these items and help some folks out.
So if you're listening and you've got some clothing, men, hanging in your closet that you haven't used for a while, make a good use of it by collecting it and donating it to Clothesline Cleaners. So what do they do? Just drop it off one of your shops?
We can take things through the delivery route. Like I said, if you're in Ada County, we can pick these items up. You can call us and we'll schedule to come by and pick them up, or you can drop them off at any one of our four locations.
So give your phone number in case somebody would like to give you a call and have you pick something up.
The main phone number is 342-0538, area code 208. That's our main plant location on Orchard and Franklin. That's where our route distribution is centered.
The number once again?
208-342-0538. 1-800-938-3738.
So I learned some other interesting things about Gary. One is that he is, you're kind of a marketing genius. I don't want to blow your ego up here. But they are sponsors of the Idaho Ballet.
Ballet Idaho is Ballet one of our good clients. We help them out with the cleaning of their costumes.
I loved your ad, so tell us that story.
Well, if you're asking about the ballet advertisement program, we've been able to assist them keeping prices very, very low for their costumes. They have some complicated pieces. But in turn for that value, they've put in marketing for us. They allow us to use pictures of their own ballet dancers in some striking pose. And the caption, I believe, says, "Clean execution. Clothesline cleaners, the official cleaner for Ballet Idaho."
God, I love that. Clean execution. That's just awesome. The thing I love about Gary is he came up in the trenches, right? So he still, first thing he said when we met was, "I can see you have your clothes professionally pressed." And he pointed out three or four things that I would have never even noticed. In Sandler, we call that reticular activation. If somebody is a carpet layer, the first thing they see is the carpeting. Somebody's a painter, the first thing they see is painting. Somebody's a clothes cleaner, the first thing they see is how do other people clean their clothes. So that work ethic and that perfectionism, and I think that attention to details, is part of what drives your standards. So talk to us a little bit about the standards that you have for clothesline cleaners.
Well, of course, we fall into the trap so many businesses do, answering the question about how good you are. We offer quality service, and quality is so subjective. And we've already talked about the competition can clean and press. That really is our common denominator. The differences for us are the level of service that we offer at the counter, the level of education that several of us in our staff have received and continuing to receive. And on those rare occasions when something goes wrong, if an item is misplaced or damaged, and we are responsible for that, getting a claim settled quickly and efficiently is absolutely vital for a customer to feel like they can continue to trust us. The dry cleaning service is a little different than most. There's no other service that touches a customer more often. More repetitively than the dry cleaner. You go to get your hair done, maybe a man 4 to 6 weeks, a woman 2 to 3 months. We get our lawn mowed once a week, but that's only seasonal. Most of us, if we have a maid, they're not in every day, possibly once a week, maybe once a month. But the dry cleaning customer typically, the regular customer typically interacts twice a week. And not just with one item or one service, but with several pieces, creating a potential problem in several different areas in one transaction. If you bring us, you know, five or six shirts a week, a few pants, the margin for error is great.
Increases.
For the dry cleaner.
And there's a chance that something's going to get lost or damaged. It's just part of life. So what you do is you work hard to settle that claim once it does happen.
Well, we work hard to minimize and prevent them in the first place. And we feel like we do a pretty good job of that. But when something doesn't come together and we fail to meet all aspects of a perfect experience, we do try and settle those problems quickly and efficiently.
Another point that we haven't talked about, but it strikes me as a matter of convenience, is other services offered. So I'm guessing, like, yeah, I've got a pair of pants that needs mended, or I've got a button that's missing. How do you all take care of something like that? And if you see it in someone's clothing, do you offer to take care of it?
Oh, absolutely. One of the questions that we cover with people that are signing up on our route, especially because we don't see our route customers and have that convenience of talking about specifics all the time, is would they like us to handle minor mending up to $10, something, a seam that's out. Buttons are usually always replaced for free, but if we have like a set of buttons that need to be replaced, minor things, most people are very appreciative that we can take care of those. If you consider getting your garment back that you sent in for cleaning and you didn't know that there was a seam out, we just put a note on it, "Would you like this seam repaired?" Now you've got to send it back in. We've got to transfer it to our tailor. It just prolongs the process. So
I
we try and
that.
Get it done as quick as we can.
And you mentioned bedding, drapery. What kind of things do you do?
Those are the different types of items that we have the capability of cleaning and caring for. We've extended our services as far as our industry possibly can, except for area rugs now. We're looking into a process where we can do area rugs in-house. Otherwise, we do all of the work in-house, all of our alterations. Our leather work is done in-house, which is expanded to purses and handbags.
Repairs.
Even than even shoes and cleaning.
Wow.
The cleaning of a leather purse is something that's very expensive to buy.
Yeah.
And then once it gets soiled inside and or out, the question is, can you clean it or do you replace it?
Right.
And a lot of times replacement is a very expensive option.
Yeah.
We do draperies, feather pillows. Huh? Of course, we've talked about the pickup and delivery, but many, many things.
So just to wrap up here, Gary, what advice would you give a business owner, manager, entrepreneur? How do I set myself apart from my competition, and how do I make sure I get the market share that I really want and deserve?
Well, I think it's essential for any business owner to be filling a niche that is not being filled.
Hmm.
There's just less competition in those areas. For us, we felt like the high-end market was not being served with a high-end dry cleaner. Many of the dry cleaners were middle of the road. We even had a couple of discount cleaners that are a one-price option, which for that niche is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But for somebody that's looking for a better level of service, a guarantee of service, having some sort of certification or education credential, that's where we separate ourselves from the competition.
So, Gary, give your contact information in case somebody is listening to us and would like to reach out to you.
Again, my name is Gary McCracken, owner of Clothesline Cleaners. And if you'd like to contact me directly, you can catch me at Gary@ClotheslineCleaners.com or my phone number. You can call me direct, 208-861-8588.
On Entrepreneur Radio, we share the stories of local and regional leaders and individuals who drive change to see how they have achieved success. If you'd like to hear how we can help you, give us a call at 208-429-9275. Or if you have a great story that you'd like to tell, or perhaps you know somebody who does, give me a call and we'll get together, have a brief visit, and I'll invite you to our studio here in our office, and we'll get your story out to the people who would benefit from it. Once again, our number is 208-429-9275. So far, we've been talking about some leadership strategies and techniques, specifically the velvet-covered brick. My guest today, Dave Arch. Dave, we talked about how I'm a self-proclaimed brick, working on adding that velvet, and you gave us some strategies. I love the concept of stand in front of a mirror and without emotions say, that could be a problem. A simple way to engage someone, a constituent you are managing, in self-directed change. Give us some more thoughts you have about really building that package with the right proportion of velvet and brick.
Well, on any given day, in the terms of transactional analysis, on any given day, I have trouble finding my nurturing parent. I want to have that velvet, but on any given day, it may not be there. I just may not feel it. I may not be in the zone. So I need to have a word track that might kick it into gear. And for me, one of the best word tracks that I've found, works for me at least, is help me understand. Help me understand. And I find if instead of reacting to whatever's going on, I come back with, would you tell me more? Help me understand how that happened. Help me understand what was going on at the time. All of those words, I find that very often the emotion will follow if behaviorally I use a word track like help me understand.
Now, if we're doing coaching with one of our constituents, is our goal to maintain low emotional expression? You mentioned the adult, and to engage them in emotional expression?
Well, I think as Sandler points out, I'm always working for a 70-30 split. I want 70% from my nurturing parent, which is very emotional, but it's the velvet part. I want 70% from my nurturing parent. That could be a problem. I want that nurturing part to be very much a part of my coaching. And then when I need to draw upon a hard truth or I need to say something that I would be tempted to go to my critical parent in, for that 30%, I want to come out of my adult. So it isn't non-emotional when I coach. I think it's very nurturing when I coach. I just need to be able to access that other 30% upon will.
And coaching is really about, well, if you boil it down, it's selling, right? I'm selling someone on modifying their current behavior, their current approach to get another outcome. And one of the things we're famous for in Sandler is saying that people buy based on emotion. So what am I looking for in my constituent to get them to that point of change?
Well, I think think it's the bonding and rapport. You know, I like when David Sandler first put out his submarine, the bonding and rapport wasn't a compartment from what I understand. I wasn't around at the time, but I understand the bonding and rapport was the water in which the submarine floated. And to me, that makes just so much sense because it permeates every compartment of the submarine. If I have a trusted advisor relationship with the person I'm coaching, they're going to be honest. They're going to be open. They're going to be transparent. If I don't, it'll be like pulling teeth. And of course, I want them to be honest and open. And just like in selling, the part that has the pain, the part that has the felt need for what I'm going to be coaching to is in the child. So I need their child to feel safe enough to come out and tell me what the felt needs are. Now, I may look at the person I'm coaching, or I may have done an assessment on the person I'm coaching. And we, of course, at Sandler use, among other assessments, we use a divine assessment. And when we use that, it points out real needs in the part of the person I'm coaching. But that doesn't mean those real needs are felt needs. And I'm always going to begin with someone I'm coaching with their felt needs. Where do they sense they have a need? And what do they want to work on? Just like with selling, early in my career, I spent way too much time planning and thinking about what I wanted to sell the buyer. I did not go in and listen to what the buyer wanted to buy. I went in with what I knew I wanted to sell. I need to listen to the person I'm coaching so that I find out what they want to buy, what they have pain around.
Yeah, they'll not only tell you what they want to buy, but how to sell them in a way that they will accept it.
Excellent point. But I've got to be a better listener than a talker or I'll never learn that.
That's, you know, right. It's funny. We were talking with another Sandler franchise owner and trainer on our show, and he made the statement that we train in Sandler communication, but there's no module on how to listen.
Right.
Give me your thoughts on what are some of the strategies required to be a good listener?
To be a good listener, I cannot feel the pressure to respond in the moment. I teach my people to sit and say, you know, in this first meeting, I really want to make sure I understand your business, your issues, and your concern. I'm going to write them down here, and then I may have nothing to say to those in this meeting because I'm going to want to take them away, think through them thoroughly so that I can bring you a thoughtful response. When I take the pressure off of myself of feeling like I need to be a quick responder in that meeting to what that person has to say, I find myself thinking about my answer while the person's talking. And then I find myself missing what the person is saying. Once I can take that pressure off myself to where this is a meeting where I've come to hear you and ask you questions, and I'll have answers, but I won't have them in this meeting because I want to bring, nobody's ever been offended. What? You want to bring me a thoughtful response? I'm offended. No. In fact, if I give them a response in that meeting, there are some personality types who will think I'm just talking off the top of my head because they couldn't respond that quickly. But, I know exactly what you need. It's better that I spend a little bit of time, even if I don't need the time. It's better that I spend a little bit of time and continue to put forth the perception that this is being thoroughly thought about. Then when I come back to them and I repeat back to them, of course, I'm repeating back to them throughout that conversation anyway, they say something. I find that I have to paraphrase, summarize at regular intervals because my mind wanders off if the conversation turns into a monologue. And so when they're talking and we're going past 3 or 4 minutes of them talking, my mind wanders. So I have to break in and break it into smaller pieces. And I do that by saying, now just before you go on, let me make sure I've heard what you've had to say up to now. Is this what you're saying? And then I paraphrase it and they confirm it or help tweak it, then I let them go on. But I find I need to break it into those pieces, not only to give them proof that I'm listening and that I've heard what they've had to say, but also to keep myself engaged. All of those are some things that I've found helpful in trying to improve my ability to listen.
Yeah, I found that there's a lot of people who are actually good listeners, but you would never know it because they're not active. So we talk about the three types of listeners. There's the competitive or combative listener, there's the passive listener, and then the active listener. And a passive listener may be hearing, but they're not engaging. So what's some strategies to be an active listener?
Well, an active listener means at least I'm in my body language. We think of the three components of communication. In my body language, I'm shaking my head, I'm nodding, I'm leaning forward, I'm listening. I'm in this attentive position. I'm not glancing at my watch.
Yeah, right.
I'm not answering my emails. Okay. You know, and then in my words and tone of voice, I'm regularly inserting, I believe I understand what you've said. And I'm regularly inserting, summarizing what they've said or paraphrasing what they've said so that they continue to be convinced that they're being heard. At regular intervals.
Right.
To me, that's active listening.
And Dave, maybe for some of our listeners that may not be familiar with transactional analysis, give us a brief overview of the three ego states we talk about and how those are active on both parts, the listener or the coach and the constituent.
The leader has three, and psychologists call them ego states, from which they can deliver their message. If anyone's ever gone parental on you, you know that there is a parent ego state. And when somebody goes parental on you, they're speaking to you from their parent ego state. Now, within the parent ego state, I have a nurturing parent in which the person cares about the person they're speaking to. I have a critical parent in which I'm being judgmental of the person to whom I'm speaking. I have a child. I have a very emotional part of me that psychologists tell us doesn't get more emotionally mature than about 7 years old. I laugh because my mom, who passed away at 92, within the last week of her life, I went up to visit her, and the nurses said, "Your mom pinches us." And I said to my mom, I said, "Are you pinching the nurses?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Why?" "They're making me do things I don't want to do." And the nurses are going, and she pinches hard. And I until she passed, that seven-year-old girl lived inside of her. And we have within the seven-year-old inside of all of us, we have the rebellious child. That's the person who is not going to be told what to do. We have the compliant child, and that's the person who doesn't want to displease and so shakes their head yes, even though they aren't really planning to do what you told them to do. And then we have the creative or the natural child, and that's the part of us that plays, and it comes out and has a good time.
Yeah.
And we know that there are many parts of life in which we need to play. And in many people, or in some people, unfortunately, that part's buried deep under all their shoulds and all of that. But there's this seven-year-old part of us, parent, child, and then there's the adult. The adult, no emotion. All emotion resides in the parent or resides in the child. But with the adult, no emotion. It's facts in, it's facts out, and the adult is able to speak with no emotion, do tasks with no emotion, and is able to do things and actually understands things that you'll never convince the seven-year-old child inside of you to believe or accept. Well, we have, as the leader, we have those three components, but so do our followers. And very often, the ego state from which we speak will determine what ego state is tripped in the followers.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dave. My guest today is Dave Arch. Dave, give your contact information in case somebody would like to reach out to you.
Oh, if you'd like to, it's dave@sandler.com. dave@sandler.com, and I will write you back.
I'm Idaho's CEO of Sandler Training, Jim Stevens. If you like the show and want to subscribe to our content, email us at crossroads@sandler.com or reach out and ask us how to subscribe at 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. Dave, so far we've been talking about the conceptual side of how do I, as a manager, get that right balance between brick and velvet. So the metaphor Dave uses is a velvet-covered brick is a manager who is, the velvet side is soft, open, and approachable. The brick side is enough structure and firmness that they can provide guidance. And in all of our roles as managers, we're often faced with different challenges regarding the people we manage. So maybe we could take a little time here to have you illustrate to us, what would this look like in, let's say, for example, I've got one of my employees is consistently late. So we're in a meeting. I was supposed to be at the meeting at 10 o'clock. It's 10 minutes after. I walk in and I say to you as my boss, sorry, I was late. I had some things I had to take care of.
In visiting with them, now, obviously, my judger says, the critical parent says, don't you ever be late again. I love, Dr. Phil has an interesting question he consistently uses. And it cuts to the core, but it is not judgmental. Is that working for you? I love that question. Is being late working for you? And I can sit back and listen to their response. And then they share with me what's working for them and what's not working for them. And I enter a meaningful dialogue. That, in contrast to shutting them down with, don't you ever be late to a meeting of mine again.
Right.
Exactly.
And so our tendency, if it's a meeting that has other people in it, we may not have the liberty to probe how
not
I handle
that.
Point,
but it's a question that I file away to ask when I'm in private with them, because it wouldn't be nurturing to do it in front of a group. I'm not, you know, to out them like that. But neither am I going to allow them to continue to treat me this way, because I believe we do teach people how to treat us. And if they're consistently late to my meetings, somehow I've given them permission to do that. I have responsibility there.
Good. So let's do a coaching session where you've called me aside and you're going to deal with this tardiness factor. So
all right.
I say to you, Dave, you wanted to see me?
I do. I have noticed from the past few meetings that you're always running 5 to 10 minutes late to each meeting. Is that pattern working for you? Help me understand more of what's going on that's causing that behavior to occur. What is going on?
Well, you know how busy I am. I mean, I've got 5 projects that are deadline driven, and I just they take a higher priority. I just needed to wrap things up.
Tell me more.
Well, specifically, we're working on that XYZ project, and I've got to get 3 people who are involved in their decision making process all on the same page. And I was just working on finishing an email to get everybody together and trying to pick a time that would work for everyone. And in my mind, that's a priority.
Let me be sure I've heard what you said. So the priority for you are the tasks that you're being given from other folks, and you just made a judgment call over, and I have 3 meetings that you've been late to, and you just made a judgment call that what you had to do back at your desk was more important than being on time to the meetings I called. Am I understanding you correctly?
Well, yeah, I guess if you want to look at it that way.
I'm sorry. How are you looking at it?
Well, I don't mean to imply your meeting isn't important. But yes, I did make the judgment call that this was more important.
Is there something I can do? Is it a time? Maybe there's something I can do to adjust the time of my meeting. If I made my meeting 10 minutes later, so instead of starting at the top of the hour at 10, I made it 10:10, would that take care of it for you?
Well, as you pointed out, I'm fairly consistently late, so I would likely still be late, I guess.
How can I help?
Well, I don't think it's your issue. I think it's my issue.
How so?
I don't know. Yeah, maybe you're right. It's time management.
I don't, you know, I want to adjust my expectations. We've got another meeting coming up next Tuesday. I've set it at 10. I can set it at 10:10 and send out a change if that would help. Where should my expectations be next Tuesday?
I will I will do my best to be there on time.
If I said it at 10:10, would you be able to say I would be there on time?
I don't think the time, Dave, makes a difference. I think it's me. I think it's my issue.
All right. Well, so my expectations then for next Tuesday's meeting, which starts at 10, will be that you'll be there at 10. And I, you know, you'll let me know if something comes up where that's not going to happen. But otherwise, that's where I'll have my expectations. Is that fair? That's what we'll do for next Tuesday's meeting. I appreciate you giving me your time and talking about this so that we can make any adjustments necessary to have you consistently there on time. Thank you.
Great, great example. In my in kind of debriefing that role play, Dave, I felt like it might be too much velvet.
It could have been. I didn't have the opportunity to see any physical reactions on your part. I erred maybe on the side of softness, but my point was still made. So I don't know that I was 30%. I drew no line in the sand. I didn't say, if you're not there at 10 next Tuesday, there'll be hell to pay.
Right.
You know, I didn't go there, but this was my first encounter. And so I would ratchet up the brick. If he's not there at 10 next Tuesday, he will feel more of my brick than he felt on my first meeting.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
I like that percentage, 70% nurturing. And I think you did a great job of demonstrating the nurturing. You fell on the sword. You assumed responsibility. You asked how you could help. You offered some benign solutions. So let's say next meeting, I'm 5 minutes late, not 10. What does the conversation sound like? I come in and say, Dave, you wanted to see me. I'm guessing it's about me being late Tuesday to our meeting.
It is. It is about you being late. You being late to those meetings is no longer acceptable.
Okay.
Is there a way we can come to an agreement that that behavior on your part is going to stop?
Well, I really did try. I almost made it. I mean, I was,
it was
a few
better.
Yeah, it was better.
It was better, but put yourself in the perspective of the people that were there on time. When you walk in late and they all worked to be there on time, how do you believe they view you? Or what kind of a perspective do they have of you and your brand when they're there waiting and you come in late? What kind of messages do you suppose they go off in their head? I'm trying to help you here because I don't think being late to these meetings is helping your brand in the company at all.
Well, I think you're right. There are... I can see people physically rolling their eyes. So I'm sure there's some level of distrust and disgust at my cavalier attitude towards the time. And frankly, as you mentioned it, I'm wasting their time as well.
Yeah. Well, I believe I watched them physically react, as you said, and I believe some of the messages that are going on, in fact, some have spoken to me about it. Some of the messages that are going on is that somehow you feel your time is more important than their time.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, they're there on time and you're not. And so your time must be more important than their time. And that just undermines the team. So that behavior needs to change.
Okay.
Well, can we agree?
Yes.
Can we agree?
Well, I agree. It needs to change.
All right.
I agree. It needs
all
to
right.
change.
So, you know, these are weekly meetings, 10 o'clock on Tuesdays. So this next one, 10 o'clock or even a little early would even be great because you got a little makeup to do with the group. Come a little early and show them that, no, you don't believe your time is more valuable than their time. And that'll help turn this thing around.
Good. Good. Well, great example. And I do. You maintain that adult, let's deal with the facts, low or no emotion, and a very nurturing kind of a, I want to help you, but you've got to be willing to help yourself. Does there come a point, Dave, where you either build an ultimatum or agree on consequences? How far do you take it if it is? I have an example in a client of mine that they've had this conversation so many times. Their idea is it's a waste of time to even have the conversation.
Oh, absolutely. There's an ultimatum. And, you know, as I say, we treat people how to treat us. And there's a point at which we just, we don't allow it to continue. If this behavior continues, then this is what's going to happen next. Be sure you can follow through on it, but there needs to be consequences.
And in something like this, is the next write them up? I mean, what's your suggestion there?
Yes. You know, usually every company has a series of steps, a warning, a write up, something that goes in their file and so on. And that's where we're going to go from here if this behavior does not change. But again, just the facts. There doesn't need to be any emotion behind it. You're stating something very substantive to them.
Yeah, and hearing you do it, I think in my correctional conversations with constituents, I probably come across, well, not probably, I come across strong enough that I may actually become the problem.
Oh, I see. Sure, right? Sure.
I'm the persecutor, and sure. even though they're late, it's my emotion that clouds their accountability.
Yeah, you're giving them a beating. Absolutely. Yeah.
My guest today is Dave Arch. Dave, give your contact information in case somebody'd like to reach out to you.
Oh, if you'd like to, it's dave@sandler.com. I'll write back.
And Dave is the author of multiple books. Give us a list of some of the books you've written.
Oh, I've written Showmanship for Presenters. A lot of them have to do with Train the Trainer arena. Showmanship for Presenters, Moving Beyond Lecture, Tricks for Trainers, a book of activities for trainers to use to spice up their training, warming up the crowd, dealing with difficult participants are some of the types.
Awesome. Yes. And many of those are available. Just go to your favorite book source, Dave Arch, dave@sandler.com. I'm Jim Stevens. My calling is to wake people up from the slumber of mediocrity. If you're tired of forgiving your employees for not trying, bored with the daily ritual of at least or just enough that allow you haunt you over the weekends, are you ready to test yourself and see if you could change or to see if your people could change? Give me a call at 208-429-9275. Ask to set up a discovery meeting. We'll set up a conversation. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement.